One on Crick Info Talk.
Hi, this is Sanjay Manjreka for Crick Info Talk. I have with me Kumar Sangakkara. In the last episode, we heard Sangakkara talk about the Asian teams in the World Cup. In this episode, I'll try and get him to start looking at some of the other teams that will be playing in the upcoming World Cup in the West Indies.
Australia, no more, at least rated number one, according to the ranking system that the ICC has. Too much to look into this, or just a temporary phase? Australia can now be beaten, and if you think they can be beaten, which are the teams who are likely to take over?
Well, you know, everyone would love to think, you know, there's a chink in the Australian armor. You know, every time they lose a match, oh, now they're vulnerable, you know, we always come up with this. But, you know, Andrew Symons is doubtful for the World Cup, the way, you know, the media has portrayed
it. Ian Chappell was saying if Andrew Symons is not playing, that's a huge setback.
It is, because he's the explosive middle-order bat and the guy who brings balance to the Australian team, because he can bowl off breaks. So they can afford to play four genuine fast bowlers and Symons. So they have the balance in the bowling attack, and Clark bowls. You take him out, you lose that the big-hitting middle-order batsman who gets the extra runs for your side to push the totals higher. Plus, you lose a bit of the balance of the side, because if Shane Watson is a good replacement, but he doesn't have the quality.
If at all there was a front runner, it was always Australia. But now things have changed, and it's just perfect for the World Cup, isn't it?
I would be insulted to not play Australia and have everyone say, well, they're a team that's, you know, not at full strength. I would like to beat them when they're at full strength. And if you have a full-strength Australian side coming, even if they're going to be the front runners, you know, it's up to the rest of the sides to beat them. And that's a huge challenge, and that's something you must enjoy trying to do, rather than get discouraged by it. And just, you know, the start of maybe a few more defeats than they're used to. You know, it's an added impetus for other sides to really look to beating these guys. But it all depends on how they react to their loss in the series in Australia, tri-series in Australia, and the Chappell Hadley Trophy now. It's how they come back from it. And the Australians usually come back hard from a setback. So either that might work to their benefit, or it might work to other sides.
They're also losing some very senior players as well. I mean, it's not going to affect the World Cup too much, but certainly the future of Australian
cricket. It is. Glenn McGraw and Justin Langer.
I mean, Damien Martin wasn't in the same league, but he's not there anymore.
Right? Yes, Damien Martin and Shane Warne. Irreplaceable. And it's a lot to ask for from the rest of the bowlers to get sides out on a consistent level, get 10 wickets or 20 wickets to win games. And sides will now enjoy the challenge of facing Australia without those two.
Which is the country that you would pick, say, if there were a three-match series against Australia? So you had to beat them not only in one game. You know, anybody can beat Australia on one day. Even Bangladesh did it. But a three-match series, a five-match series. Which is the one or two teams that you would pick in the world who are capable of beating the Australians or giving them the toughest time?
I would say New Zealand. They've always done exceptionally well against Australia. And they just lift their games up because they hate losing to the Aussies. Sri Lanka has always done well against Australia. We've had that bit of unpredictability in the past, you know, of being a 340 side or maybe, you know, 200 side. You never know. But we've changed that, you know, in the recent years, and especially now where we get consistently high totals. And we've basically done very well against Australia. And it'll have to be a toss-up between, I would say, England. South Africa, and maybe, I'm not really sure about England, but I would say South Africa, maybe India. Pakistan is, again, as I said, they're unpredictable, and the amount of pressure they have to go through to play Australia can either lift them or break them. So I would say those are the sides that have realistically a chance of beating Australia on more occasions than not.
Kumar, I know you're a guy who just doesn't restrict yourself to what's happening on the field, doesn't stay in the present. You think a lot beyond the action and beyond today as well. Gazing into the future, I mean, 400 is a score that has been achieved twice. Sri Lanka did it,
43, I think, against Holland.
Yeah, which is the highest score in one-day cricket. Just 57 runs more and you could have a 500 in one-day cricket. Now, a few years back, people would be saying 400 is impossible. But now you have to start looking at the possibility of 500 runs being scored in a one-day game, in a 50-over match. Could it happen in this World Cup?
I don't think it'll happen in the World Cup. But I would think it's quite a possibility. Just because in the past year we've had 443, 438, 434, 418, 392. These scores have been achieved in 1 year. Either it's because of the 5 overs of the power play after the first 15.
So it's more sort of restrictive overs. So
restrictive overs, yes. And also, the wickets have got better. You have to admit that. Bowlers are suffering quite a lot because of the fact that, you know, crowds and television expect there to be a lot of runs scored in a one-day game. But again, you know, a challenge to the bowler now to be recognized as a person who can bowl on flat wickets. And you know, if you can prove that, you are, then you're in a different class or different league of bowlers. If the wickets get better and unequal sides play, I think 500 is a real possibility.
Ian Healy said this a couple of years back, you know, because there is a certain trend that you get into, you know, when you're playing cricket. And it's generally the way everybody plays. You know, 15, 20 overs of restriction, there is a certain amount of intent to attack. And then sort of there is that little bit of lull where you take your foot off the pedal. And again, the pedal is pressed in the last 10 overs. And I used to often wonder why the intensity dies down in the middle stage when the pitch is still flat, when it's still got wickets in hand, there aren't great bowlers bowling at the time. But just that intensity, it's something that you just get into a fashion of batting in one-day cricket. Do you think that could also be a reason that somebody will show the world that the same intensity can be there in the middle stages as well?
I think it's quite a possibility, especially as we were talking about before, more all-rounders come into the game. If you have two frontline fast bowlers and you know, maybe another Jacques Cullis, you know, in your side, if you have two of them. You know, so then you're playing nine batsmen, so you can afford to go hard in the middle overs where you don't have to feel ashamed to get caught out on the line trying to push the score on, where, you know, more in the field spread you think more singles, so we try. But if you can get a boundary and over, why not try it if you have the depth in your batting lineup, which can carry you over. So,
and when you look at it, it's 11 batsmen and just 50 overs.
And just 50 overs. So the time to really lose a lot of wickets is less, even though, you know, Sri Lanka managed to do it quite often in the top order in the recent series. But I think, as you said, that will be probably be the next change in ODI cricket, where the middle overs are exploited to such an extent that it drives the totals up even higher. And the sides that do it will again run away with the trend and run with the momentum and will be
and the others will look to
will look to follow.
We're coming to the end of our interview. Just a couple of personal questions. I heard from somewhere that when you came back from Australia, was it that you took out some of the stuff from your kit bag and filled it up with books? Is that true? I mean, it's quite incredible a cricketer to do that.
No, that was a long time ago. I think in South Africa, where I go to a lot of bookstores, and even New Zealand, there was a fantastic old bookstore in I think Dunedin, where we were staying.
So you actually next did that, filled up your...
I like to read. And
what do you read?
I read anything from classics to history to modern fiction, everything. I like history a lot. So any and all books that I find interesting, I try and purchase. And India is a great place to buy books because I think the prices are fantastic.
And on the streets of Kolkata, I think you should sometimes just take a wander around Grand Oberoi and you'll find some books there.
I would love to. But, you know, the modern itinerary doesn't really give you the time to do it.
Yeah, we take up all your free time. I find it hard to connect this man who reads so much and talking the way you do. That is the same man who's behind the stumps saying all those things that got so much attention, more than the cricket that was played in South Africa. Sometimes I wonder whether it is deliberate, you know, whether you are in control of yourself, you know exactly what is happening there. Shane Warne does that. You know, his aggression a lot of time is controlled. It's almost an act. With you, do you actually feel that way when you're doing it, or it is something that you do as part of the game, as maybe a psychological ploy?
If I'm to be honest, I think when I started, I sometimes would get carried away with it. But we talk a lot of having disciplined aggression in everything we do. And things you do must be measured to get the reaction you want from the opposition and not make you react in a way that's going to, you know, be detrimental to your game. And I think that's the art to it, not to be offensive, which is another important thing to be, I reckon, but to make sure that whatever you do is to instigate a reaction that's going to be to your advantage. And as you said, disciplined aggression is the key. And I think I've learned a lot over the years, and I've quietened down and mellowed down a bit. And I
and
think
you seem to do it only against those teams, that against all teams in the world. Got your favorites.
I think we do it a lot against South Africa.
Any
because
reason?
Yes, there was this one tour in 2002, pre 2003 World Cup. Then we went there and we were put under a lot of pressure verbally during the practice games, the first test, which we lost.
And you're talking about players only, not the crowd? Or
not the crowd. I was talking about the atmosphere in the center of the pitch. And it was, to a certain degree, quite offensive after a while. And we sat down as a team and decided, come the second test, we're not going to take this lying down. And we really saw the South Africans crumbling. And they paid more attention to us than their game and nearly handed us that match on a platter. Yeah. So from that day onwards, we realized that that's one of the
and
ways.
And who were the volunteers in the team who said, I'll do it?
I think our team had gone through so much that everyone,
okay.
Everyone, even Marvin, who is one of the quietest, most unassuming people you meet on the cricket field, was the one who said, I think now's the time to really go hard at them. And as I said, that's a tactic we use against the South Africans because we know that they take it quite personally when you do that, and they come down in their level of play and they try and compete more on things away from the game rather than watching what they do.
Was it something specific that Ian Healy told you? Was it specific to your style of keeping, or was it just the general principles of wicket keeping?
It was more general principles of wicket keeping. You know, we always see wicket keepers, you know, who take the bills off in a flash and, you know, who take the spectacular catches. But he made me understand that the hands and all of that is basically subject to how well you move your feet and your body. And he was talking a lot about powerful body positions, making sure that your legs work hard and your body is carried to the position where you want to be in very quickly. And once you're in the right position with your head over the ball, he told me that the hands are naturally going to follow. Okay. And the moment you get your body positions right, he said, you will take catches to spinners that you never thought were possible.
Okay. And was there a sea change when you applied it?
It's a lot of, and a few other things where he always told me to never to rush things at practice, never to get someone to hit the ball hard at you. He told me never, that's the biggest no-no, because that's going to get you into bad habits and you're going to get used to not moving. And he always said, if you're going to catch, make sure that you have enough time to catch the ball and make sure you finish one side first. So if I'm catching, I now practice catching only on the right side first. So I finish my right side, then move to the leg side. And if I'm keeping up to the wickets to spinners, I make sure I have a shadow batter. But I finish, let's say, right-handers offside first, then move to the right-handers leg side, left-handers offside, left-handers, you know, onside. So to make sure I break them out up into compartments, because he always said, the bowler runs in 20 yards, you have 22 yards of wicket, then you're standing back another 15 yards. So you have all that space and time to see where the fast bowler is going to bowl the ball. You're not going to be confused. You don't have to worry about going right or left, because
you'll never be short of time.
You will have plenty of time and you know where the ball is going. So why confuse yourself at practice? Mm. And his theory was always make sure that you practice hard enough and well enough so that your team has the confidence in you, that you prepared the best that you can to perform well in the middle, and that you have the confidence knowing that you've done everything possible to be competent with the gloves out in the middle. So he every single situation is replicated at practice, but done at a slow, measured pace where you have the time to be in control.
Nothing like right advice at the right time. It just changes a cricket. I've seen it with so many cricketers. We were talking about scores of 500 and things. Do you see this World Cup giving a new kind of idea for teams to play one-day cricket? Because in 1996, obviously, when Sri Lanka won it, there was the first 15 overs exploitation. Then, you know, New Zealand tried spinners. And there is always something that, you know, remember. Do you see something different that the world will offer to the sport?
I hope it does. But if you ask me, I'm not really sure what it would be. It could be how to exploit the power plays even better. It could be the middle overs that you talked about, where more runs are scored then, so that the slog overs become a bit easier. It could be bowlers changing the length when they bowl in the power plays. It could be, you know, 10 overs of Yorkers. You never know. Maybe 15 overs of Yorkers. Mm. These things might happen. Batting orders might change and things like that. But I think a lot of the sides have now accepted that to be consistent, they have to have consistency in their sides, with their bowling, with their batting lineups, their batting positions. So maybe the pinch hitters will finally go out of the game, and we'll settle down to batsmen doing the job that's asked of them, or being replaced if they're not competent. So hopefully there'll be something special. Maybe hopefully it's from Sri Lanka, but you never know. We'll wait and see what happens, but it'll be interesting.
Final question is about, you've said, I think, previously on record, because I have it here on record, is that you believe that life should be led in moderation. Tell us something more about that.
Well,
that's my principle as well. I believe in moderation. I've always found, you know, nice balance in between the high and low, you know, the medium that is there in life.
I'm a great believer in that. One of the things is, you know, I'm a Buddhist. I may not be the most pious of Buddhists, where I go to the temple every full moon day or every opportunity. I don't do that. But I find it very attractive because it's more philosophy based on science and cause and effect.
It's a beautiful religion, so actually, the discipline that it teaches.
It is, and it's all about, you know, as you said, discipline of mind, and which will then lead to the discipline of the body, and not going to excesses, which is great, because that gives you a balanced perspective on life. The Sri Lankan team now talks a lot about having a balanced and positive lifestyle. That doesn't mean only about cricket, that means off the field. Because if you have a quality and productive life away from cricket, I think it gives you a much better perspective on the game that you play. It detaches yourself at the times you want from that sport, so it gives you an idea of how to do it better. You know, not just being a Buddhist, I think all religion basically teaches the same things, to live a good life.
Do you think that's easier to practice in Sri Lanka than in India? Live life in moderation in India as a cricketer?
I don't know.
It's a tougher challenge, isn't it?
I mean, the whole of Asian society is based, I think, on these principles, but we as Asians sometimes are known around the world for excess, you know, when we have something, we flaunt it. But I think being Asian, I'm very proud to be Asian, I'm very proud to be Sri Lankan, because I think societies and families, and you know, we're such a close-knit society, we're such close-knit families, and that's very important, I think, being raised and nurtured to do the right things, and we have that in it being, you know, Asia, and you know, when you go to an Asian country, you're accepted as being, you know, part of the Asian family. So we have a lot of positives going for us, and I think if we get our mindsets right and we appreciate that a bit more, I think there'll be a lot of good things happening in India.
And I do believe that as an Indian, if you go out in the world looking like an Indian, you'll get more attention than trying to be somebody else.
I think that's always the case. Okay. I think, you know, we have the heritage and the culture of thousands of years behind us, and I think we should be proud to have our place in that history and you know, carry on that legacy. And even in cricket, you know, Asian cricketing tradition is magnificent, and we produce some of the best players in the world. So we have nothing to feel inferior about or second best about. I think our idea should be to go out there, compete on level terms with anyone on the cricket field, in life, and to conquer the world. You know, it's out there for you to enter and you to do well in. So I think those opportunities should be exploited to best effect.
It's always great talking to you, Kumar. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much, Sanjay. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, Kumar Sangakkara. That was very enlightening, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. This is Sanjay Manjrekar for Cricket Info Talk.
One on Cricket Info Talk.